Good morning, friends. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Thursday, April 21st. All you people out there, 420 couldn't last forever, right? So hopefully you're in a better frame of mind today. No, seriously, I think the best of my listeners. Though I'm a little foggy-headed today, actually. No coffee this morning. Got to have a little blood work done after the show. So if I sound especially groggy, then that's the reason. 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to call and be a part of the program today. One thing I want to discuss today is why we love straw men. Something that actually our general manager, Mr. Leo, a.k.a. Freak Daddy Brown, got me thinking about on a Facebook post. So we'll talk about that a little bit. Straw men, of course, the idea that when you're in an argument with somebody, we tend to construct shallow caricatures of their argument that are easily pushed over, like a straw man. Therefore, it makes us feel good about ourselves, but we really haven't addressed the significance of their argument. So we'll talk about that a little bit. Also, Father Alan Carter during the second hour on the, and I'm making air quote signs here, the typical week in the life of a priest. I remember, you know, even when I was a Methodist pastor, and it's a little bit of apples and oranges, but, you know, you get that question from time to time. What do you do all day? Or, you know, you'd always hear after your Sunday sermon, well, Reverend, must be nice to know you got the rest of the week off. No, they didn't really talk like that. I don't know why they did that, why I did that. But the point is taken, right? People don't know what pastors do. People don't know what priests do. And believe me, I know a Catholic priest, it's like, sometimes it probably feels like one of those plate spinners in the circus, you know, different plates going, spinning at the same time. We'll get Father Alan Carter's take on what the typical week in the life of a priest is. And I put it in air quotes because I'm sure it changes depending on the week. We'll talk about St. Paul's Say What sermon and how religious freedom intersects with medical care. It is the feast day of St. Anselm, perhaps best known for his what's called ontological argument for the existence of God. And that will frame our question of the day that we'll get into in the next segment. Of course, we'll also spin the Dalek Catechism wheel, make our What Were You Thinking nominees, and look back in history, all that and more. And as I said, welcome your calls, 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to call or text. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Yeah, so couple my lack of coffee with the fact that I got in really late last night. I think I was telling you yesterday, was invited down to a Catholic parish. Actually, it was a home gathering, but part of a Catholic parish in an area about an hour and a half, 2 hours south of Lexington, where we broadcast from. This was associated with my full-time work with the Diocese of Lexington as the director of family life. I had been invited to this parish to give a couple of marriage talks over the last couple of years. And then back in January, they started having these home gatherings of adults to talk about some of the church's more difficult moral teachings. And I'd been down in February to talk to them about so-called same-sex marriage and the church's insistence that marriage by its very nature exists as the union of one man and one woman. And they wanted me to come and have a dialogue about that, explain the position so that they can better understand it, because people struggle, you know, as you know. I mean, they have friends who self-identify as gay or lesbian, and the last thing they want to be seen as is a bigot or a hater. And so there was a house full of people back in February. They asked me to come back in April to talk about contraception and natural family planning. I didn't know what to expect in terms of a crowd. I really, if I'd have thought about it, I would have anticipated it was going to be a significant drop-off. There were about four people there last night. But that's okay. It was good. And I took with me half of a natural family planning teaching couple in our diocese, and another woman who is a young professional woman and mother who is an advocate for natural family planning. Of course, natural family planning, that means of fertility stewardship, of fertility awareness, in which a couple can identify the fertile window and the longer infertile window in each monthly-ish fertility cycle of a woman, and therefore if they have a legitimate read, a need, a legitimate reason to space a pregnancy or to avoid a pregnancy, they can practice periodic abstinence, something which respects the nature of the sexual union, which is oriented toward as a marital act of complete self-giving, oriented toward a fruitfulness and an openness to life. And so it's a different approach, one that respects the mystery of fertility and the nature of the sexual union, but also understands that that we are called to engage our reason and be responsible with this mystery and gift of fertility. So, you know, I, of course, there could have been a lot of reasons that people weren't there last night. I mean, it's a busy time, spring sports, all the rest. But also, I mean, let's face it, if you are not embracing this aspect of Catholic teaching, then you don't want to go and sit and hear about it. And of course, maybe you have concocted in your mind what the night's going to be like. Some sort of finger-wagging diatribe against the evils of contraception. That's really not what it was at all. It was more of a presentation, really, to help people see more clearly how this teaching of the church is actually rooted in, I think, common desires we have as human beings for what authentic love is, for what marriage is, and the very meaning of our bodies. Anyway, but one of the things that I was mindful of in talking about it is people have a lot of straw men on this particular issue. Again, by straw man, I mean a caricatured version of an argument that is easily pushed over. And so when it comes to this idea, for example, of this aspect of the Catholic vision, namely that every sexual union between spouses to be an authentically marital act should be open to life, it is so countercultural in people's minds and so out there. You might as well be in the tinfoil hat society in people's minds when you start talking about this stuff. They have their own straw man version. In other words, why does the Catholic Church teach this? They'll say, oh, well, it's because the Catholic Church is hostile to science. Straw man. In fact, look back over the history of scientific inquiry and you'll find prominent Catholics at the forefront. Priests, people like Copernicus, for example. But then people, but Galileo. Well, read the more rational accounts of that whole situation. Again, I'm not saying mistakes weren't made, but the Catholic Church is not hostile to science. Also, another straw man is that people think that the Catholic Church opposes artificial contraception because it is artificial, as if the church is anti-science, anti-technology. The church is all for insulin pumps, for example, or, NICU technology. So the technology has nothing to do with it. Even the artificial reality has nothing to do with it. It's the fact that it's contraception, that it contradicts the very nature of marital union in actually sterilizing the act. Or they'll say, well, Catholic Church just wants people to have as many babies as possible so they can fill the coffers of the church. As I've said many times, among the arguments or the straw men on this issue, there is none more ludicrous than that, because let me tell you, as the father of seven, I give a whole lot less to the church than I would have if I didn't have seven children. So this idea that, you know, the church encourages breeding so that we can fill up our churches is, again, absolutely ludicrous. So here's the thing, right? And this is what Leo got me thinking about, because a couple days ago I played this clip that was put together by some family group out in Washington State, in which this guy was going around to students on campus, and he was interviewing them about the whole reality of identity. And, you know, it was really kind of meant to expose sort of the intellectual the intellectual, what's the word I'm looking for? lack of coffee kicking in here. I guess the superficiality, the intellectual superficiality of this sort of therapeutic culture and these young people who were being asked questions about what if this guy was a 5'9 white guy, you know, what if I believed I was a woman? And then he went into, what if I believed I was Chinese? What if I believed I was 6'5"? What if I believed I was a 6'5" Chinese woman, right? And it was really meant to reveal in some way that they couldn't tell him he was wrong because everything was about how he felt inside. And I mean, I'll admit it was funny. I played a clip of it on the program, but you know, Leo posted something on his show page that said arguments like this, in which we try to almost mock somebody and create straw men out of their arguments, that they make us feel good, but they don't really accomplish anything. And as he said, rather look for the good in what they're saying and then try to redirect it. So if their desire is for, you know, the human dignity and respecting human dignity, well, that's not out of keeping with Catholic teaching on us being made in the image and likeness of God and the idea of that we all have an interior freedom. What we should do rather than poke fun is seek to redirect to a deeper grasp of truth. So we'll get back to this because I think it's an important point. This is the Mike Allen Show. Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this feast day of Saint Anselm of Canterbury, who lived back in the right around the first end of the first millennium into the second millennium, a bishop of Canterbury in England, probably best known for what's known as the ontological argument. Now, what is ontology? Ontology is really deals with the nature of being itself, existence itself, the nature of things. And Anselm had this I remember learning about this in a philosophy of religion class years ago. And it is sort of a sneakily mind-blowing kind of an argument. It at first it seems like, well, that's just silly. And then you start thinking about it, and it actually is a bit of a head scratcher, and hard to disprove, so to speak. But anyway, the ontological argument, I'll try to sum it up as best I can. Again, philosophy not exactly my wheelhouse. But the idea goes something like this in the ontological argument from God. By definition, this is Saint Anselm, God is a being. Of which nothing greater can be imagined. So God, as we understand, God who is omniscient, who is omnipotent, who is, you know, all present. He is a being which is no greater can be imagined. Number two, a being that exists in reality is greater than a being that does not necessarily exist, right? So in other words, if this is God is the greatest thing that you can imagine, well, the greatest thing you can imagine is something like that that actually exists as opposed to something that just exists in the mind. Number three, therefore, if God exists as an idea in the mind but does not exist in reality, then we can still imagine something greater than God, right? So if you can imagine that this God exists in your mind, but not in reality, then there exists something still greater, namely that which exists in the mind and in reality. Point number four, but we cannot imagine something that is greater than God, or else that thing would be God, correct? So number five, if God exists in the mind as an idea, then God must exist in reality. Number six, God exists in the mind as an idea. Number seven, therefore, God necessarily exists in reality. Like I said, the first time you read that or hear that, you're like, say what? But then you start to read about it and think about it, and it is a, it is not easily dismissed. Now, we don't live in a day and in a culture, frankly, where logical train of thought sort of thinking prevails. We are much more attuned to emotional arguments than we are rational arguments. But St. Anselm, oftentimes credited with really being the first one to begin systematically thinking about proofs of God. And of course, there are others that have emerged over the centuries, right? The argument from the order of the universe, for example. Others choose the idea of the argument from the interior moral sense that we have, kind of the moral argument. C.S. Lewis presents this in his book, Mere Christianity, that we all have within ourselves a belief in certain objective standards about right or wrong, and we have, you know, if you doubt it, go steal money from an atheist. They will not only be upset with you that you stole the money, but they will even appeal somehow that this was morally wrong. So a belief in some sort of higher moral truth that's not just an inconvenience for them, but is some sort of transcendent standard. That argument is often made that points to a reality of God. Otherwise, how would we have any sense of moral standard at all? So there are a whole host of it. So my question for you is, what do you think is the best argument for the existence of God? What do you think is the best argument against the existence of God? 573-4-BREAD-4, that's our question of the day. 573-4-BREAD-4. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. You can call or text 573-4-BREAD-4. Posting on Facebook, which is always an option, Mike Allen Show there, or Twitter. Father Gary says St. Anselm's ontological proof for him is the strongest argument for the existence of God. Shannon says something interesting. She says the best argument for the existence of God is suffering. And the best against the existence of God is suffering. I have to contemplate. I'm used to suffering being placed there as an argument against the existence of God, right? If there's a good God, one who is all powerful by nature and also all good, why is it that we suffer? Wouldn't a good God like a good parent as much as was within his power? Which, if you're by God, everything is within your power. Wouldn't you stop suffering? Therefore, if suffering exists, there must not be a God, or certainly not a good God or an all-powerful God. So I never thought about suffering being an argument for the existence of God. I guess maybe, and maybe Shannon can clarify, give us a call. Maybe what she's saying is when we suffer, it automatically prompts within us a desire for meaning in that suffering. And perhaps that desire for meaning points us to a reality that there must be some transcendent goodness which we have been in some way denied. That yearning in and of itself points to the reality of the presence of a real goodness which we desire. So we'll get into more of that, but if you want to chime in, 573-4-BREAD-4, call or text, email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. I'm not sure how effective, quite frankly, arguments for God are in terms of, you know, apologetics. And I think it's extremely rare. I would never say never, but I think it's extremely rare that people are argued into faith in God. I think these sort of arguments can be helpful to the person who's struggling with faith to see that it's not irrational to believe in God. But as far as convincing the unconvinced, I'm not sure how effective they are. Checking out the sports ticker from last night, Cleveland with a big win over Detroit. They seem to be hitting their stride, the Cavaliers. Looks like it may come down to Cavaliers Heat in the East. And then still questions about Steph Curry's ankle and whether he's going to be able to play Game 3 against the Rockets. Golden State seemed to take care of business the first two. Of course, now, I think, heading off to Houston. So see if they can not only surpass the Bulls' 95-96 record, but sweep through the playoffs. That's the big question mark. And let's see, baseball action. St. Louis getting a measure of positivity out of their big series with the Cubs, at least winning the third game in that series, 5-3. And now the Cubs, who so far look like they've been the class of baseball, heading to play my Cincinnati Reds this weekend after sweeping them in Chicago. The Reds get them four games at home this weekend. But the Nationals sitting there at 11-3. And, oh, Dusty Baker, getting it done with the Nationals. Dusty Baker, who got run out of town on a rail out of Cincinnati. I miss you, Dusty. Anyway, let's go to our What Were You Thinking nominees for the day. We've got a few. I like this story here. Two Laguna Hills residents, this out from Santa Ana, California, pleaded not guilty Monday to planting weapons and drugs in a woman's truck in an effort to get her arrested. Jennifer Michelle Beal, 37, and Kevin Brown, 42, were arrested Thursday on a warrant charging them with conspiracy to commit a crime, false imprisonment, and making a false report. All felonies. They are accused of planting a BB gun, a 12-inch hunting knife, and methamphetamine on the bed of the truck belonging to the 40-year-old woman. Evidently, the Orange County Sheriff's investigators found the gun and the drugs in the victim's truck when they went to her home, but she recognized the sunglasses case packed with methamphetamine as allegedly belonging to the man, the woman charged with planting it. In other words, she planted meth in this person's car in her own recognizable sunglasses case. note to self, when you're going to frame somebody, don't use one of your own belongings as one of the props. Just saying. Second one, let's see. Well, I thought I had a second one in here. This is actually more of a positive What Were You Thinking, I guess. Man trolls plane passengers by painting sign on his roof welcoming them to the wrong city. That's a pretty brilliant idea if you think about it. 6-foot-tall lettering welcomes airplane passengers to the city of Cleveland as they touch down in Milwaukee, prompting many to panic that they've boarded the wrong flight. Really? You're going to get freaked out by the sign on the top of a house? That's a pretty brilliant joke, though, you got to say. But the winner, I'm going to give the winning award of the What Were You Thinking to ESPN.com, who posted a story yesterday, the day the Browns passed on Big Ben. Talking about the Cleveland Browns passing on Ben Roethlisberger in the draft back in the day. As if it's not hard enough to be a Cleveland Browns fan. What, do you just open that gaping wound and pour salt in it? We'll be back. The Mike Allen Show. We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show on this Thursday, April 21st. Certainly welcome your call or text. Talking about arguments for and arguments against the existence of God. This ties in with what we were talking about earlier with straw men and actually engaging arguments based on their merits and taking people seriously in what they believe as opposed to assuming the worst about them or their most shallow point of view, but actually engaging people in their own words and their own thoughts. Arguments for and against the existence of God, they've been around for a long time. It is St. Anselm's feast day. What prompts me, he's the one who came up with the so-called ontological argument for the existence of God. So what do you think is the best argument for? And what do you think is the best argument against? That's really not a bad thought experiment in learning to engage with people either, is to try to think through their point of view. So love to hear from you on that. 573-4BREAD-4, call or text or email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Casey, posting on Facebook, says that the moral argument for him is the most convincing for God. Without objective morality, there would be no basis to say any action is good or bad. That's why those who dismiss God because of the existence of evil have a dilemma on their hands. No doubt, as he says, the existence of suffering is emotionally powerful, just not intellectually so, in my opinion. So we'd love to hear from you. You can post your response on Facebook or on Twitter as well. We talked yesterday about the Republican and Democratic primaries in New York, Hillary Clinton winning over Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump not just winning big, but pretty much crushing any hope of Ted Cruz getting enough delegates before the convention. But as a funny aside, Jimmy Kimmel, who does his what's called lie witness news, where he goes out, has correspondents go out on the street based on the principle that people who have a television camera on them will say anything, even make up stuff. And so they go out onto the streets in L.A. and they ask people who they voted for in the New York primary that day. Now, obviously, if you live in California, you're not voting in the New York primary, except, I guess, by absentee ballot. But no one wants to admit that they didn't vote, and so they lie. Thus the title, Lie Witness News. We'll listen in.
How was your polling place this morning when you voted in the New York State primary here in California?
It was pretty great.
Was it busy?
Yeah, very.
What were the lines like?
Long.
Who did you go with?
I went with my aunt.
So big morning this morning, obviously, is the New York State primary here in L.A.
Yes.
How was your polling place this morning? Was it busy?
Yeah, busy. Yeah.
What were the lines like?
It's kind of long.
What borough did you vote in this morning? Hollywood or Queens?
Hollywood.
Yeah. And did you take the Long Island Ferry to get there, or did you walk, or?
I took the ferry.
You took the ferry. How was it? Was it choppy out there?
Yeah.
Big morning here in L.A. It was the New York State primary. How was your polling place this morning? Was it crazy busy, or were you okay?
Yes, it was busy. It was all right, but I got through.
Were there a lot of New Yorkers at the New York State primary today, or?
Yeah, there was, but it's okay.
How could you tell who was a New Yorker and who was a Californian at your polling place?
Because I find that us Californians are more friendlier.
Did you register to vote in the New York primary here in L.A.?
Yes.
Yeah, what was that form like? Was it crazy that they made you identify different types of pizza, different types of bagels? What did you pick? Did you say you eat pizza with a knife and fork or just straight by hand?
Honestly, I don't even remember what I put. I kind of like jotted through it. I really just tried to make sure I was eligible to vote, so.
I appreciate your honesty.
Yeah.
Was it difficult to get to your polling place on time because of the different time zones? Obviously, the 3-hour difference.
Yes, it's a lot of math that you have to do to get there.
Who did you go with to vote this morning?
I'm by myself.
Oh.
My friend's going later, so.
Oh, is your friend also a lie?
Yeah.
I see. All right, thank you so much. Would you like a sticker?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness. That is funny. Now, who knows how many people they actually interviewed before they could get those comments, but human nature, I guess, loves the spotlight. I like the guy who said he took the Long Island Ferry to get to his L.A. polling place. That's pretty good. Anyway, interesting article in the Washington Post about a kinder and more disciplined Donald Trump. You know, I guess that probably is true. I have not, of course, now I don't follow things quite that closely. I don't watch a lot of TV news, but I haven't seen across the web anyway major faux pas from Donald or crude or obnoxious things coming out of his mouth quite so much anymore. And this Chris Saliza in the Washington Post saying that's really by design. It shows that Donald Trump is now listening to his advisors. And, you know, now that he seems to be on track to potentially win the GOP nomination before the convention, that they're, I guess, gearing him toward the general election in November. The idea being, of course, you appeal to the base in the primary, and then when it comes to the general election, you move toward the center. And as Chris Saliza says here, the new Donald Trump should scare the heck out of the GOP establishment. So it'll remain to be seen whether the Donald can be continue to be more gracious. Evidently, he's given up calling Senator Cruz lying Ted to actually calling him Senator Cruz. So there's going to be a lot of drama in this thing, but it does appear like he kind of has momentum back in the GOP race. And the only hope I think that the establishment has, or the Republican Party has really, of nominating somebody other than Donald Trump is they've got to get to a contested convention. If that happens, then I think there's all kind of possibilities that could go forth. But that certainly Ted Cruz's abysmal showing in New York did not help him. Like I said, I don't think the New York values comments that he made some time ago did him any favors. That's for sure. Let's look back in history a little bit on this day, April 21st, throughout the ages. There have been plenty of things happening.
Where are we, dude?
These are the circuits of history, gentlemen. They'll take us to any point in time we wish.
Where are we?
Gentlemen, we're history.
Don't know much about history.
All right, so in 753 BC, according to the traditional date, Romulus and Remus founded Rome. In 1506, on this day, was a three-day Lisbon massacre came to an end there in Portugal with the slaughter of over 1,900 suspected Jews by Portuguese Catholics. It's not hard when you look up these things every day, things in history, you discover plenty of instances of Catholics behaving very badly. It's like I say, you know, we in the Catholic Church, as I've told my friends who are not Catholic, we have the best and the worst of everything. People of great virtue and humility and love, saints. And then we also have the worst. So like, for example, yesterday, I think it was, we talked about yesterday was the simultaneously the birthday of Mother Angelica, who may be canonized one day. It's also was the birthday of Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler, who grew up Catholic, at least in his early years, and there in Austria. So the best and the worst, we've got it all. 1509, another Catholic, at least started out that way, Henry VIII became king. We know how that ended. 1649, let's see, the Maryland Toleration Act was passed, allowing all freedom of worship. Maryland's whole foundation, interestingly enough, very Catholic, kind of a safe place for Catholics to be in the colonies. Let's see, in 1918, the World War I flying ace, Manfred von Richthofen, better known as the Red Baron, shot down and killed after killing, I think, over 80 other pilots in shootouts. It's happy birthday to Queen Elizabeth today. She is 90 years old. 90 years young. She's been queen now for 63 years, I believe. Prince Charles, I'm sure, wondering if he's ever going to take the throne. 65th birthday today of Tony Danza. We'll forgive Tony Danza for Who's the Boss by remembering his run in the show Taxi, very underrated show. On this day in 1958, Andie MacDowell, the actress born, she's 58 years old today. In 1980, on this day, the famous Rosie Ruiz Marathon, in which Rosie Ruiz skipped the first 25 miles of the Boston Marathon and ran into victory in the 26th mile. You know, give her props for thinking outside the box. In 1980, Tony Romo, born on this day. So Tony Romo, 36 years old today. If you're a Cowboys fan, of course, you're thinking about the future and how many more seasons is Tony Romo going to play? How many healthy games will he play this year? We'll see. I don't have anything against Tony Romo, but he has been a lot of heat and not a lot of light in his career. 573-4-BREAD-4 if you want to call or chime in. We're going to get into this a little bit more in the next segment, arguments for and existence of God, for and against the existence of God, and also this understanding of straw men. While we love them because they're easy to push over, but they're not really intellectually honest. And if we're going to engage people in the merits of their arguments, we got to begin by respecting their own dignity and their own thought processes and thinking the best of them. So we'll get into all that when we come back from the break. Again, if you want to call 573-4BREAD-4, call or text. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Back in a few minutes, this is The Mike Allen Show. Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Leanne Womack there. I'm not sure if that's a song that got much radio airplay, but I mean, start with the fact that I could listen to Leanne Womack sing The Phone Book. But even so, that's a good song. It speaks of one argument for the existence of God, the argument from nature and the argument from beauty. You know, it's not necessarily a deeply intellectual argument. More appeals to human experience. But I was talking to somebody about this yesterday, my good friend William. We were on our way down to this talk that I told you that I gave, or this dialogue at this home south of where we broadcast from, on the topic of the church's teaching on sexuality and contraception and so forth. Anyway, we were just talking about, he does a lot of work with different biological processes and stuff, and the ag industry and ag work. And he's just talking about how fascinated he is by the things that he discovers at a bacterial level, that it really is awe-inspiring and mind-blowing what happens even at the most microscopic level of bacteria ordering themselves. And that's one of the things I think that with the emergence, of course, the microscope, it is, they've gotten ever more powerful. One of the very interesting things is that the smaller things don't get somehow less complex. But those who discover these things are actually blown away by how much complexity there is, even at a cellular and a microscopic level. Now, does that prove anything deductively or I guess not. But here's the thing for me. It's so hard for me. I can understand the appeal sometimes of atheism. You know, we live in a hard world. You look around and there are difficulties, there's suffering, God sometimes seems hidden. It does take faith to believe in God. But at the end of the day, when it boils down to it, I simply can't. Whether it's the world that we observe, like Leanne Womack sang about in that song, whether it's microscopic bacteria and the complexities of life, whether it's just my own interior thought life, it's just so difficult for me to come to a place where I believe that everything that exists has no purpose or meaning and is simply a random combination of chemicals and accidents that has no governing being, no transcendent reality, no ultimate truth, that I just can't go there. To me, that seems nonsensical. Why is there something as opposed to nothing? Why is there even existence at all? Now, keep in mind, that's a long way from the fullness of Christian revelation and the belief in the God of Christianity. But to not believe that there's anything beyond pure matter, to me, is such an intellectual stretch. It's not even conceivable. But maybe you don't have that problem. I'm really interested today in what do you think is the best argument for the existence of God, but I'm also interested in what do you think is the best argument against the existence of God. This on the feast day of St. Anselm in the Catholic Church, probably best known for his ontological argument for the existence of God that really involved nothing more than our own thought processes and a being greater than which we could never imagine, and that that being must exist in reality. 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. You can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. And, you know, I'm not just asking the arguments exist against the existence of God just for the illusion somehow of balance. I really want to hear what people are thinking, because, as I said earlier in the show, I think it is really, really important in discussion and debate and argument that we hear other points of view on their own merits and not as we make them into caricatures. Because, as I said, we do this all the time in so many ways. And we Catholics are guilty of it too. We are very guilty of assuming the worst, for example, sometimes about Protestants. I get into this at times with a good friend of mine who doesn't see it the way that I do. Imagine that. That I feel like that he has a very caricatured view of Protestants. That, and particularly maybe Catholics who leave the practice of the Catholic faith, maybe they were raised Catholic and they end up at some evangelical megachurch. And I don't just hear this from him. I hear this from other Catholics too at times. Oh, well, you know, they're just after entertainment. They just want to go someplace where they can be entertained with good music or, you know, sip on a latte while they blend in into the woodwork and aren't challenged to live out the Christian life. That's what they're after. They're looking for easy Christianity. Well, that may be true in some cases. I mean, I don't know people's hearts, but I could tell you that there are others who, for whatever reason, did not find themselves in the Catholic Church. They did not experience any sort of interior transformation. In other words, the faith to them growing up, for whosever fault it was, I don't know. Maybe it was their own closed-mindedness. But they never really engaged with the faith at a personal level. It seemed simply as outward practice and empty ritual. And perhaps they ended up drifting away from the church, then got invited to go to an evangelical church where they heard a very warm and personal presentation of what it means to love and to follow Jesus Christ. And it sure seemed richer than maybe what they had experienced from their own background. And they really had a genuine interior conversion of heart, and they found themselves being fed in their faith, learning the scriptures, perhaps all sorts of things. And, you know, there are very serious-minded Protestant Christians who really do want to live the faith as best they know it. Do they have the fullness of the faith entrusted to the Catholic Church, the fullness of revelation? No. The Catholic Church is the fullness that has received from Christ, the fullness of the truth. As in becoming Catholic, it was not a rejection of who I was as a Protestant Christian. It was a fulfillment of it. But at the same time, I think we have to take people seriously and respect their experiences. I'm not saying that validates their experiences necessarily, but we at least need to respect them. And we should receive the same treatment, in my opinion, when we talk about issues. Case in point, and I was talking to the kids in my class, I teach a class to juniors on the sacraments. I was talking to them about this. I can't remember if it was yesterday or the day before. We were talking about issues in which they may disagree with the Catholic Church. And believe me, there are plenty of Catholics who will say, you know, I'm a Catholic, but I don't agree with the church about blank. And put in the blank, it usually has something to do with the church's teaching on marriage or sexuality. Probably 3 out of every 4 times. And just what I said to them as juniors, because they're at that point in their life where they're really having to grapple with whether the faith they've been raised in will be their faith and whether they will own it and live it. And I said, look, you're a free person. We're all free persons. We're going to believe what we believe, and no one can make us believe otherwise. It's part of the privilege and the responsibility you have as a human being made in the image and likeness of God. And you may very well choose to reject something that the Catholic Church teaches or believes, some moral truth, for example. You may choose to reject it. You're a free person. Here's the thing I would ask of you. Make sure if you reject it, that you're rejecting the actual teaching and not just a caricature, not just a false presentation, not just the straw man that others have created. So, for example, you know, you say, for example, if you were to reject the Catholic teaching that marriage is by nature the union of one man and one woman, which, let's face it, according to opinion polls, a lot of young Catholics reject that teaching. Why do you reject it? Is it because you think the Catholic Church hates gay people? Now, come on. Any fair-minded reading of the church's teaching, that's not to say there aren't individual Catholics who are hateful. Of course there are. You'll find that anywhere. But what does the church's official teaching says? It says time and time again that all persons have sacred and infinite dignity and are to be respected. And unjust discrimination is an offense against human dignity. Yeah, it makes you feel good to say, oh, well, they're just haters and bigots, and therefore I'm rejecting it. No, take the argument seriously from its own merits. The church in her teaching does not hate anybody. In fact, extols the dignity of every human person, no matter who they are, where they've been, what they've done. But there's a serious rational reason. You may disagree with it, but at least engage the argument itself and not just some media soundbite. Unfortunately, they don't have a lot of help from the world that we live in, because there's a lot of more supposedly intellectually mature adults who buy into straw men all the time. We'll be back with a new hour, including Father Alan Carter. This is The Mike Allen Show.